nouns of special note. These grammarians would claim things like this sort of capitalization disfigures one's writing. And capitalization for emphasis actually started to be explicitly proscribed in the 19th century. So it went from being a preference, this can disfigure your writing, to being a proscription, don't do it. So at this point, capitalization is mostly restricted to the start of the sentence, proper names, and titles when they occur with the person's name. We go back to President Carter with a capital P. According to the Chicago Manual of Style, we are not to capitalize titles even when the referent is specific. So, for example, it would be Dean Munson with a capital D, but the Dean, lowercase d, even if I'm talking about Dean Munson. That is, unless it is direct address, in which case I would use a capital Mr. President or Ms. President with a capital P or Senator with a capital S. But you will certainly see capitalization of the Dean or the President, which I read as an attempt to be formal or to be polite in recognition of the importance of that position. In some ways, I think about it as capitalization as respect. I know that this practice drives some people crazy, but I have to say there isn't a clear intuitive logic, at least to me, that when we're talking about President Roosevelt, for example, we would say President Roosevelt with a capital P, but then use a lowercase p with the president when we're talking about the same person. Brian Garner, in his usage guide, points out some other contradictions that we struggle with as we try to figure out capitalization practices. For example, he points out Stone Age is a capital S and a capital A, but Space Age is all lowercase. And Garner provides some leeway for capitalizing, saying that sometimes capitalization can work well for a particular rhetorical purpose. But he does ask us to minimize our capitalization, to use it only when we have a specific rhetorical purpose in mind. Now, other capitalization issues that might trip you up, for example, you have to figure out whether the in a newspaper title is actually part of the title. For the New York Times, the is part of the title and it is capitalized. But for the Los Angeles Times, it's not part of the title and it is not capitalized. In 2016, it made headlines when the Associated Press changed its style book and decided to stop capitalizing internet and web. The AP, when they made the announcement, said that most people viewed both of these nouns as generic, and I have to say that many of us had stopped capitalizing internet and web a while ago. But when these headlines came out, there was widespread criticism of the style book for the lowercase letter in internet. For example, there was an article in Slate that said, "There's only one internet, and it should be capitalized." In the end, I have to say a style manual is going to be key here that you're going to need to figure out for if you're working on a formal piece of writing, what does that style manual say about what needs to be capitalized and what shouldn't be? And I myself am quite interested in what's happening in informal writing, in texting, and on the internet. No capital letter there for me on the internet, where you see some folks returning to capitalization for emphasis. And I think that that's an interesting turn back in time to use capitalization for emphasis in these informal writing spaces. And you see in these spaces that people are using lowercase I. And since we're talking about the pronoun I, let me try to answer the question of why do we capitalize the pronoun I? Okay, but here's the problem. I can't give you a very good answer to this question. Here's the history. This pronoun used to be spelled I-C, it was pronounced each, and it lost that final consonant by about the 12th century to become just E, which eventually was pronounced I. By the late 1300s or so, the letter, that represented this pronoun started to become taller. Now, we don't know exactly why it started to get taller. One is maybe people just thought it didn't look good as a lowercase letter. It was an aesthetic issue. It could also be that they were trying to distinguish the pronoun I from a shorthand I that was shortened from in or from if. But in any case, that I got taller and became a capital letter, and it has been pretty consistently capitalized in written standard English ever since. Now, why the I is capitalized is one of those mysteries of the language that we don't have a great answer to and can strike non-English speakers as odd. And those speakers may also find it odd that English is capitalized in English, as not all languages consider the names of languages to be proper nouns. In French, je, which is the pronoun for I, is lowercase j. And languages like anglais for English and français for French are not capitalized. In German, in contrast, all nouns are capitalized. The formal U, Z is capitalized. But I, the pronoun for I, is not capitalized. In addition, in German, adjectives for nationalities like American or German, not capitalized. In English, they are. Different strokes of the pen for different folks who speak and write different languages. In this lecture on determiners, the question of how determiners compare with adjectives has come up. So let's talk about adjectives in detail in the next lecture, rounding out our discussion of the many key components of the noun phrase. And then we'll turn to the complicated tangle of the verb phrase.
Lecture 9. Funnest lecture ever.
Let's start this lecture on adjectives with another recent question from the usage ballot for the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel. This question was on the ballot that I received in fall of 2015. The question is about the word fun. Now, as you know, when we get the ballot and we get these questions, we're given sentences and asked to rate them in one of four categories: completely acceptable, somewhat unacceptable, completely unacceptable. In this case, with the word fun, there were five sentences that we were asked to rate. The first three sentences under fun are ones that I marked as completely acceptable. And I would guess that many, if not most of you, do not have concerns about these sentences either, or at least not very serious concerns. In fact, when I give you these sentences, you may even be wondering why they're on the usage ballot at all. So here are the sentences. The party was really fun. Let me say that again. The party was really fun. How are you going to rate that one? Here's the second one. That party was so fun. That party was so fun. And here's the third one. We went to a fun party. We went to a fun party. Why would anyone be concerned about these sentences? Now, maybe you're feeling a little concerned, but when I survey people, they say, I don't know, all those sentences seem fine to me. Maybe the so fun is a little colloquial. I might not use it in formal writing, but all the sentences seem grammatical. The answer to what might be wrong or what people might be concerned about lies in the history of the word fun. The word fun is only relatively recently an adjective. It shows up in English as a noun in the early 1700s. And it's hard to know exactly when it started being used as an adjective. I have found examples of very fun, and once you can get very fun, you know fun is working as an adjective. I've found those as early as 1910. But it isn't until the middle of the 20th century, the 1950s or so, that you can find fun as an adjective with any regularity. Now, interestingly, when I went to the Oxford English Dictionary to see what they were recording in terms of the noun and the adjective use, the entry for fun has not yet been updated to include the adjective. The entry only has fun as a noun. But then again, that entry was first published in 1898 and hasn't yet been fully revised. It's relatively easy to understand how the noun fun got reinterpreted into the adjective fun. Let's imagine a sentence like, "The party was fun." That would have been said early in the life of fun, with fun as a noun. So the party was fun would be like saying, "The party was chaos." But if children in particular are hearing sentences like, "The party was fun," it's very easy to reinterpret fun in that case as an adjective. We could say, "The party was great. The party was terrible. The party was fun." Fun sure looks like an adjective there. And kids, when they hear it, might reinterpret it as an adjective, and sure enough, they did. Now, as someone who teaches younger speakers of the language on a regular basis, I ask them about these sentences with fun, and at this point, younger speakers see the adjective fun as completely standard. There are some lingering concerns from people who may have lived through some of the transition between fun as a noun and fun as an adjective, but I think that those concerns are dwindling. I was actually struck when I looked at Brian Garner's usage guide and his entry on fun when he argues that fun as an adjective remains casual at best. I'm not sure that's entirely true. It may be that in formal writing, we aren't always talking about fun things, that the context in which we use the adjective fun may often be informal, but I'm not sure that the word itself is completely casual. Back to the usage ballot. And now let's look at the last two sentences in the entry on fun. Here's the first of those sentences. "That party was funner than I expected." Remember, you get to rate this as unacceptable to acceptable. "That party was funner than I expected." And then here's the last sentence. "That was the funnest party I've been to this year." "That was the funnest party I've been to this year." If you are cringing right now, especially about funner, you are not alone. Funner and funnest can elicit very strong reactions. I have actually been in auditoriums where people have booed when I have said the word funner. But let's take a closer look to see if funner and funnest are really wrong. What's wrong with them? And this takes us back to the newness of the adjective. As a noun, the word fun takes more and most. You would say more water, because water is a noun, and you would also say more fun. We had more fun, with fun as a noun. And this is why, right now, fun as an adjective often still takes more. It sounds more correct to people because in its life as a noun, it took more. But let's think about other one-syllable adjectives in English and how they make the comparative and superlative. Let's take an adjective like tall. We make the comparative taller. We make the superlative tallest. Let's take wide. Wide, wider, widest. Smart, smarter, smartest. Blue, bluer, bluest. Fun, funner, funnest. I know you're cringing, but you can see the pattern that what's happening here is that kids, when they learn the language and they learn that fun is an adjective, they try to make it behave like other one-syllable adjectives. That is a completely natural thing for kids to do as they're learning the language and looking for patterns. So they will say funner and funnest until they are corrected by some adult or an older child who says, "No, no, it's not funner, it's more fun." And then they will record that as an exception. Now, I think we may be watching a shift in attitudes here. Students at the University of Michigan have a much stronger reaction to funner than they do to funnest. With funner, when I have tried out that sentence from the usage ballot, they say, "Ugh, funner is terrible. That sentence is unacceptable." When I give them the sentence with funnest, they say, it's not great, but I might actually say it. That one doesn't strike my ear as terrible. And I do wonder if the iPod advertisement that describes the iPod as the funnest iPod ever, and there are big billboards that say the funnest iPod ever, might help funnest gain traction. What is my prediction for the long term? My prediction for the long term is that the kids will win. This is what often happens with language change, that the kids who are trying to make fun behave like other one-syllable adjectives will, in the long run, be the people who change the language. And the long run will probably see funner and funnest. I would guess that funnest will come in first, given that people right now don't seem to have as strong a reaction that funnest is wrong, and then funner may scoot in on funnest's coattails. My advice for now would be beware of funner, and probably beware of funnest too. Certainly not something that you're going to want to use in writing of any formal kind, and you may get judged. That said, I do want to just step back here and think about why the word funner elicits such strong reactions. People will say, it sounds terrible. But think about the word runner, which is completely standard. There's nothing about the sound of funner that's terrible. It's just that our ears have somehow been tuned to hear it as wrong. I decided to use this usage question about fun, funner, and funnest as our introduction to a lecture on adjectives, because one of the characteristic features of adjectives is that they can create comparatives and superlatives. We'll talk about that issue along with double comparatives, and then we'll turn to an odd set of adjectives that mean different things depending on where they appear in the sentence. At the very end of this lecture, we'll talk about how to handle noun phrases where the adjective, oddly, shows up after the noun. For example, attorney general. We'll start with comparatives and superlatives. As I mentioned, one-syllable adjectives typically take a final ER or EST to form the comparative and superlative, tall, taller, tallest. These inflectional endings, ER and EST, are the oldest way to create comparatives and superlatives in the English language. English as a language used to rely much more heavily on inflectional endings than it does now. And the historical antecedents of ER and EST as endings were the default comparative and superlative endings in Old English. The use of more and most is newer. It occurs to some extent in Old English, and it spreads slowly through the 14th century and peaks in usage in late Middle English. Then, in the history of English, something unpredictable happens. By the Renaissance, we see the inflected forms with ER and EST reasserting themselves. It looked like more and most were going to win, and then suddenly those ER, EST forms come back into the picture. So when you look at the history of English, this is fascinating because the history of English is generally about the loss of inflections. We've lost an enormous number of inflectional endings over the course of the last 1,000 years. But speakers are unpredictable, and around the Renaissance, we see a resurgence of the ER-EST forms. Now we have something of a division of function, where ER and EST are used for shorter and sometimes more frequent adjectives, those with one and two syllables, tall, taller, tallest, happy, happier, happiest. More and most are used for longer adjectives, and sometimes these are less frequent, adjectives with three syllables or more. Beautiful, more beautiful, most beautiful. We don't say beautifuler or beautifulest. You can use more and most with two-syllable adjectives as well. So as you've seen, those two-syllable adjectives can go either way. They can take ER, EST, or more and most. With one-syllable adjectives, the comparative and superlative with ER and EST occurs as high as 96% of the time. And with that statistic, again, I want you to think about fun. This is one of the reasons why fun may very well start to take funner and funnest as its standard forms. There are some less common one-syllable adjectives that will often take more most. Think about the adjective apt. We will often say more apt or most apt as opposed to apter and aptest. With three-syllable adjectives, it's pretty much always more and most. So what's going on with those two-syllable adjectives? Sometimes it can feel like a free-for-all, but it's actually not a total free-for-all in terms of how those two-syllable adjectives will pattern. Let me tell you briefly about a study by Alexandra Darcy, who's at the University of Victoria, who did a study of New Zealand English. And her study suggests that when one and two-syllable adjectives precede the noun, it favors the ER-EST ending. So, for example, the coolest school ever, as opposed to the most cool school ever. When the adjective, that two-syllable adjective, is out in the predicate, it tends to favor more and most. Sam was a little more cool, as opposed to Sam was a little cooler. Now, clearly, you could do either there. This is about tendencies. We also know that the sound of the final syllable of those two-syllable adjectives can be part of the pattern of what they will do to make a comparative or superlative. For example, adjectives that end in Y often prefer ER and EST. So happy, happier, easy, easiest, wealthy, wealthier, wealthiest. Adjectives that end in full, F-U-L, tend to take more and most. We would say more hopeful and most cheerful, not hopefuller or cheerfulest. At least as a general rule, that's not what we'd say. The adjective mature tends to take more and most, more mature. Simple, that adjective prefers ER and EST. In other words, there are some patterns with two-syllable adjectives. Studies of comparatives and superlatives in contemporary spoken English will turn up a not insignificant number of double forms. And notice what I did with that double negative there. A not insignificant number of double forms. And these are usually with two-syllable adjectives. What do I mean by double form? I mean something like more wealthier or most deadliest. These kinds of double forms can now be pretty severely judged. When Alexandra Darcy did her study, she found them about a little over 7% of the time. As I said, these forms are now severely criticized, including sometimes they are called illiterate. But, of course, I'm going to turn to the history of the language. Here I go, telling you that once again, if you look at the history of the language, you're going to see that you can find those double forms. These historical figures that we now deem to be very literate sometimes used double comparatives and double superlatives. These double forms used to be, as far as we can tell, more common in Middle English and Early Modern English. And as I noted, they're not entirely uncommon today. Here are some examples from Shakespeare. Let's start with Measure for Measure. To some more fitter place. There it is, more fitter. Here's one from King Lear. To take the basest and most poorest shape. Most poorest. And here's another one from King Lear. Harbor more craft and more corrupter ends. Now, interestingly, the three adjectives in those examples from Shakespeare have all sorted out in different ways in modern English. Corrupt now almost categorically, or at least very often, takes more and most. So more corrupt, most corrupt. Poor, as a one-syllable adjective, tends to take ER and EST, poorer, poorest. Fit, the ER and EST ending is more common, fitter, fittest, but more fit and most fit are far from uncommon as we talk about our fitness levels. When I did a search of this in the corpus of contemporary American English, it looked like the ER-EST, the inflected forms of fit, were about 2.5 times more common than more fit and most fit. Of course, there are some adjectives that at least theoretically can't take comparative and superlative forms because their meanings do not allow for comparison. I'm talking about adjectives like unique, equal, perfect, pregnant. But you will notice that I said at least theoretically. In fact, all four of these adjectives do show up with comparatives and superlatives if you look at actual usage. This creates a usage issue. Should we allow it? Well, let's look at perfect and unique to start. More perfect is perhaps the most famous in the U.S. given the phrasing a more perfect union in the preamble to the Constitution. So here's the preamble of the Constitution, the relevant passage. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Is this wrong? Is more perfect union wrong? Patricia O'Connor and Stuart Kellerman provide a useful defense of the phrase on their blog, Grammarphobia. They argue there that the phrase more perfect is capturing the process of striving toward perfection, so that we are trying to get closer to this ideal of perfect. It's not that we're more than perfect. It's the striving toward the ideal. Now, the issue with unique is different. Here we are getting a change in meaning. The word unique goes back to Latin. It goes back to unicus, which means single, sole, alone of its kind. And that goes back to Latin unus, one. The word unique comes into English via French. It appears in the early 17th century, and it means one of a kind. You can see that root of one there. But by the mid-18th century, there are already examples where unique means remarkable or unusual. Now, lots of people still don't like this. I do want to note that some people think it's brand new that we just started using unique to mean remarkable. It's not that new. And I do understand the concern that it doesn't match where unique comes from. But this kind of semantic weakening is actually not that unusual in the language. If you take a verb like quell, it used to mean kill, and now it has weakened in meaning. All that said, with history and what's happened to unique, it is probably still the case that you should be careful with more unique in formal writing. When the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel was surveyed about unique in 2004, 66% of the usage panel still disapproved of the sentence, "Her designs are quite unique." And it can't be quite unique if unique can't be compared. If it's one of a kind, it's one of a kind. But that 66% is down from 80% who disapproved of that sentence in 1988. The editors of the American Heritage Dictionary point out that there also can be some very rhetorically effective uses of comparative unique, such as this sentence from Martin Luther King Jr. And here I'll quote, "I am in the rather unique position of being the son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of preachers." I'm not saying that you need to use unique comparatively, and it's probably still worth alerting students and others to this issue. But it is helpful to know that criticism of more unique is not indisputable. And if you're sitting there thinking about how is one more pregnant, here's an example. As I became more pregnant, I found that I craved ice cream more. So it does seem like pregnant, you shouldn't be able to compare. But in fact, over those 9 months, you can compare how pregnant you are. Let's now return to the distinction that I brought up earlier with the position of adjectives, which is whether they appear in attributive position before the noun or in predicative position out in the predicate. The examples I gave you were coolest school and Sam was a little more cool. So the attributive position, just to review, is when the adjective happens right before the noun, coolest school, and predicative position is when it occurs in the predicate after a linking verb like was, Sam was a little more cool. Most adjectives behave pretty similarly in both places, although we talked about whether those two-syllable adjectives might favor E-R-E-S-T or more most, depending on where they appear in the sentence. That said, there are a few adjectives that typically, if not exclusively, appear only in attributive or only in predicative position. The adjectives former and latter appear only attributively. The former point. We don't say the point is former. The adjectives awake and asleep typically appear only predicatively. The student is asleep. We don't tend to say the asleep student. But we can imagine a context in which you and I are looking at an auditorium of students and I'm trying to point one out and I say, oh, look at that student. No, no, not the awake one, the asleep one. And there we see asleep in attributive position. Another set of adjectives mean different things when they are used attributively and predicatively. This is one of those idiosyncrasies in English. Let's take the example, the adjective late as an example. If we put it in predicative position, we get something like, his wife is late. Okay, so the traffic was bad. Compare that to his late wife. Now suddenly, his wife is no longer alive. So you can see late means differently depending on where it appears. The adjective sheer also changes meaning depending on where it appears in the sentence. We could say, the curtains are sheer. That's about the material of the curtains. There we see sheer out in the predicate. That is quite different from a sentence like, that is sheer stupidity, where we see sheer in attributive position, and now this is no longer about fabric. In sheer stupidity, sheer is doing a kind of intensifying work. And there are a couple of other adjectives that can work similarly when they appear in attributive position. For example, someone can be perfect, but they can also be a perfect idiot, in which case they're probably not perfect. Of course, a perfect child is perfect, or at least trying to be perfect. So what we see here is that there's some ambiguity when perfect appears in the attributive position. A perfect child, there we have perfect meaning without flaw. A perfect idiot, we have perfect meaning that this idiot corresponds to the prototype of idiots. In all of the examples of attributive adjectives I've talked about in this lecture, the adjective has appeared before the noun. But we have a few phrases in English where the adjective appears after the noun, usually because these compounds have been borrowed from French. Attorney general may be the most common of these, but we also have the solicitor general, the postmaster general, the surgeon general, and similar expressions. Then there is the poet laureate and professor emeritus or professor emerita. You'll notice that these are often official titles, sometimes part of government or law, for example, heir apparent and court martial. These phrases, these compounds, are mostly left over from the Norman conquest, and really post-Norman conquest England, when French and Latin were the languages of court, law, and mobility. And we see a lot of French borrowings coming into English in these areas of the vocabulary, including that noun plus adjective construction, which is typical of French. The usage issue is, how do you make these nouns plural? Let's take attorney general. This is the attorney who has the most general jurisdiction. So the plural, at least in theory, should be attorneys general. And that's how it usually is in writing in American English. But in British English, you can find attorney generals. The same is true for making the plural of poets laureate, surgeons general, and heirs apparent. What about court-martial? This is an ad hoc military court that tries people accused of violating military law. You will typically in writing find courts-martial, where the noun takes the plural, but you can also find court-martials in speech. There may be some confusion here between court-martial spelled M-A-R-T-I-A-L and court-martial with M-A-R-S-H-A-L. And the court-martial, S-H-A-L, is the judicial officer who provides security and handles other processes in the court, and that would be court-martials. In sum, if you find yourself writing about attorneys general or poets laureate or courts martial, remember that these nouns are quirky in their Frenchness. Check your intuitions about where the adjective is in that compound and put the S on the first word, not the second. In this lecture, we've talked about a few quirky things about adjectives, including ones that mean different things depending on where they are in the sentence. In the next lecture, we will turn to verbs, a lexical category that has some fascinating irregularities. For example, have you ever asked yourself why the past tense of go is went? It's such a common verb that we can learn it as children without ever considering just how odd it is. This course is our chance to step back and understand these aspects of English grammar in just this kind of detail.
Lecture 10. Going, going, went.
Two women walk into a bar. One asks the other, "How did your interview go today?" The other answers, "It seems to have went well." Are you cringing? Did that sentence make you wince? Were you expecting a normal walks into a bar joke and then I threw a grammatical pet peeve in there? Or did you not notice? Were you ready for the punchline of the joke? What I said in the joke, what the second woman said was, "seems to have went well," versus "seems to have gone well." I looked online to see if people were feeling concerned about this construction, "have went." And what I found is that there's a lot of correction out there about this, including some criticism that "have went," someone said, "there's no such phrase." But of course, there is such a phrase, which is why people are writing about it online. They're writing about other people saying things like, "we should have went." Now, in these comments online, there are some far-fetched explanations where people are throwing out language about the subjunctive and particles to explain why other people are saying things like "have went." But we don't need that terminology to explain this particular feature. This is about the simple past tense form and the past participle, as well as about some idiosyncrasies in English verbs. When you think about it, as I asked at the end of the last lecture, why is the past tense of the verb go went? Why would a G turn into a W? That's my teaser, and we'll come back to that to answer the question about go and went, as well as what's going on with have went in a few minutes. But let's start by clarifying past tense versus past participle. How do you create the past tense of a verb? It can seem like such a straightforward question, not even worth asking, but it is worth asking. You add a final ed, except for all the verbs where you don't do that. Adding the ed, that ending is true for the majority of verbs. Talked, walked, played, dined, stayed out late. But then there are verbs that make the past tense through an internal vowel change. Think about sing and the past tense sang. Drink, past tense drank. Swing, swung. Hold, held. Run, ran. Help, hope. Oh, wait, no, not that one. But it actually used to be help, hope. In Old English, if we go back 1,000 years, there were 2 classes of regular verbs. You had what were called weak verbs, and those ended in an ed, what has become in modern English ed. And then there were strong verbs that made the past tense through an internal vowel change. And if you're trying to make sense of why some were called weak and some were called strong, please don't try to do that. They're just the labels on those categories. And what you're going to see is that the weak verbs actually won. Over time, many strong verbs, the ones that took an internal vowel change to make past tense, became weak, started taking a final ed. For example, help moved from past tense hope to helped. Swell, the past tense used to be swole, became swelled. Step, the past tense was stop, became stepped. Shine is still undergoing this change. It still has the past tense shown, but you are often also hearing the past tense shined. So as lots of strong verbs became weak verbs, the remaining strong verbs came to be seen as just irregular verbs. But when you look at those irregular verbs, you can actually see patterns. Look at the vowel pattern in sing sang, swim swam, drink drank. You can see that those all belong to the same class in some earlier period of English. And then there are some completely irregular verbs, such as go. The past tense of go used to be gone, which makes more sense. But that past tense was replaced by the past tense of wend, went. Now, wend had to get a new past tense, and it took wended because go took the past tense went. We call this a suppletive verb, where a verb takes a form from another verb. The past participle of verbs is formed differently for those 2 different classes of verbs. This is why it's helpful to know about the history of strong and weak verbs. The past participle is the form that we use in the perfect aspect. And the perfect aspect is when we have the auxiliary has or have plus the past participle. So has talked, have talked. The past participle is also used in passive constructions, for example, was written. How do we form the past participle? Well, with regular verbs, we form the past participle with ed. So the past tense is exactly the same as the past participle. I talked, past tense. I have talked, past participle. With irregular verbs, there's often a vowel change in the past participle form, and sometimes a final en. So here are ones where you just get a vowel change. Sing, past tense, sang, past participle, sung. Swim, past tense, swam, past participle, swum. But then there are ones where you get that vowel change and the final en. Write, past tense, wrote, past participle, written. Give, gave, given. If we return to the verb swell, we can actually see competing past participles. Swell was a strong verb, so it was swell, swole for the past tense, swollen. The past tense has now become regular, so we get swell, swelled, and then the past participle can be regular, swelled, or irregular, looking back to its past and be swollen. The verb go keeps that initial G in the past participle. So we get go as the infinitive, went as the past tense, gone as the past participle. Now let's return to have went. Think about all those regular verbs where the past tense is exactly the same as the past participle. We walked, we have walked. With irregular verbs, the past tense and the past participle are typically different. We drank yesterday, we have drunk. We went, we have gone. Now, there can be an understandable tendency to regularize those irregular verbs, at least to the point where you make the past tense and the past participle identical, just the way that regular verbs work. If you do that, you get go, the past tense went, and then you would keep that past tense as the past participle and have went. Drink, past tense drank, and then if you want to keep the past tense as the past participle, have drank. Will, have went, and have drank win because they are more regular? It's hard to know, but they might not. Languages can maintain a lot of irregularities for a long time, especially with common words like go, drink, and run. This use of the past tense for the past participle with have went, have drank is also widely seen as non-standard. And so whether that's going to suddenly get a change in attitudes and those will be seen as standard, we should stay tuned. Hard to know, but they could remain non-standard for a long time. And while regularization, as we've seen there with folks who say have went, can be a powerful force, sometimes we create new irregularities in the language. For example, dive dove, sneak snuck, maybe drag drug? Let me explain. The verb dive. What is your past tense of dive? Do you say, I dove into the pool or I dived into the pool? Right now, both are seen as standard, and dove might be winning. If you think historically, though, the past tense of dive historically was dived. It was a regular verb, and then we introduced this irregular form, dove, and it seems to be taking over. It probably comes through analogy with drive drove, dive dove. What about sneak? Well, this new past tense snuck is an Americanism. Brian Garner, in his book Modern American Usage, still describes snuck as non-standard. The historical past tense is sneaked. And Garner describes it as non-standard, even though he notes that snuck appears almost as often as sneaked in modern print materials, which raises the interesting question of how common snuck has to be before it gets called standard. The American Heritage Usage Panel is willing to call it more standard. In 2008, 75% of the panel accepted snuck as the past tense of sneak, which interestingly is up from 33% accepting it just 20 years before. What about drag drug? Well, drug is not nearly as widespread as a past tense of drag, but it made for a great teaching moment in my own career. I was at one point talking about sneak snuck and how we've created this irregularity, and one student raised his hand and he said, you know, the other day I heard somebody use drug as the past tense of drag. And I, being quite interested in this, turn to the rest of the class and I say, how many of you are drug users? And as soon as I heard it come out of my mouth, I thought, oh, that's not what I meant to say. And I said, don't answer that, don't answer that. So I don't know how many of them have drug as the past tense of drag. But in any case, the irregular new past tense, dove, as well as snuck, are becoming standard. They're becoming standard, irregular past tenses. And to show you the kinds of irregularities we can maintain without even noticing, let's consider the verb to be. The present tense of to be. I am, he, she, it is, they are. Past, was, were. Okay, now we have a W where before we started with vowels. Past participle, been. Okay, now we have a B. present participle being, the infinitive be. Okay, that's a mess. What's happening here is that we actually have three different stems that came together over time into one verb. We have the be stem, we see that in be and being. We have the W stem, was, were, and the vowel stem, which you see in things like am, is, are. The present tense of the verb to be also has more forms than any other verb. You have first person singular am, third person singular is, and plural are. Other verbs just have two present tense forms, the base form, which we sometimes call the infinitive form, and the third person singular form, which ends in s, at least in standard varieties of English. In some dialects, there's just one present tense form. It's exactly the same as the base form or the infinitive form. So you have she walk and he go. Something like she walk is right now considered non-standard, but it's arguably completely logical and the completion of a long-standing change in the language of losing verb inflections. In English, we used to have many more inflections on verbs. For example, we had a final EST, as in thou sayest, and a final EN, as in they sayin. All of those endings have fallen off except for the final S in the third person singular. When you think about that third person singular S, it is redundant. There's no vital information lost if you say she walk rather than she walks, because the way modern English works now, the subject, she, is always going to come before the verb. So you know it's third person singular. You don't actually need the S. Of course, there's a lot of redundancy in grammar. It can be helpful, but I'm just pointing out that we don't actually need that S. At this point in the lecture, we have covered four of the five forms of every verb. You have the base form, sometimes called the infinitive form, such as talk, sing, go, be. You have the third person singular, talks, writes, or talk, write in non-standard varieties. Past tense form, talked, wrote, and the past participle, talked, written. The fifth form is the present participle, and that is made through the base of the verb plus ing, talking, writing. This form is the most regular form in English. It doesn't matter whether this is a regular verb or an irregular verb. Even the most confusing verbs are regular in the present participle. Confusing verbs like lie and lay. What is going on with these verbs? Brian Garner calls lie and lay, quote, one of the most widely known of all usage errors. And I have to say, maybe you are one of the lucky people who does not have to pause to think about whether it should be lie or lay or laid or lain. I'm not. I have to pause. We have two verbs here. Lie, past tense lay, present participle lain, have lain. Then we have lay, past tense laid, and then have laid for the past participle. In Old English, let me explain why this is so confusing. In Old English, there were some intransitive strong verbs, verbs that don't take an object, like lie, that had a related weak form, an ed verb, that could be used transitively or causatively, that could have an object. In other words, a verb like lie had a related verb that meant to cause something to lie down. And that verb was created from the past tense of lie. So you have lie as the infinitive and then to lay it down, where you have that causative verb. This is why the past tense of lay, which is intransitive, looks identical to the base of the transitive verb lay, whose past tense is laid. Speakers and writers have been confusing these two verbs for over 500 years. You have lie down, but then lay myself down to sleep, and it becomes lay because myself is now the object. Now, do you lie low or lay low when you're hiding out? I realized recently that I could do both that I would often say I'm laying low. Brian Garner describes lay low as loose, but he recognizes that it is common, and he actually quotes William Safire, the language pundit who wrote for the New York Times Sunday Magazine for years. He quotes him, among others, as using the past tense, I laid low, in published writing. There's some chance that our confusion about lie low versus lay low is influenced by the fact that something like a virus can lay you low. So this is a pair of verbs that can confuse even the most grammatically confident of writers, or at least make them pause. Now that we have all these forms, we can talk about the grammatical information that they carry within a sentence, such as tense and aspect. I'm going to spend some time here because some of this terminology, such as perfect and progressive, will come up again in future lectures. And the way we pack information into verb phrases is fascinating. All right, let's start with tense. Present, past, future. Or maybe not. Some linguists will say that English has past and non-past. For example, so they will say we don't have future because we don't have a future tense that is inflected. We only inflect the past with ED or with that vowel change. You can use the present to describe the future. For example, the plane lands at 5 p.m. Of course, we do express the future, but as I said, not with inflectional endings. We use auxiliary verbs such as will, or less formally, gonna, and we'll come back to auxiliary verbs in the next lecture. Let's now turn to aspect. We're going to talk about two categories here, progressive and perfect. Aspect is about how we view an event with respect to time versus when it occurred in time, which is about tense. All right, we'll start with the progressive. The progressive is used to describe actions that are in progress at the moment we are talking about them. Okay? So, if we're talking about right now, I could say, for example, her husband is cooking right now, because we're in this moment and that is happening right now. It's in progress. Let's imagine we're talking about a past moment and I want to describe what was in progress at that moment. I would say her husband was cooking when she got home. When she got home is that moment in time, and her husband was cooking is what was in progress at that moment. You'll see here that all aspect has tense. I gave you an example in the present tense and an example in the past tense. The perfect is a little trickier to explain, but here we go. The perfect describes an action in the past and its relation to another moment in time. Let's start with the present perfect. The present perfect describes an action that began in the past and is still happening or is still relevant now. Examples will help here. I have run 5 miles. That's the present perfect. And we use it because I started running at some point earlier, but it is still relevant now. I have run 5 miles at this moment. Or another example. I have read half the book. So I started at some moment in the past. It's still relevant in the present. I have fallen in love. I fell in love in some moment in the past, and all indications are that I'm still in love. The past perfect describes an action that began in the past and ended before another moment in the past. All right, again, let me give you an example. I had run 5 miles when my shoe fell off. Okay, so I had run those 5 miles until this other moment in the past. That other moment in the past is when my shoe fell off. Another example. I had read half the book when I decided it wasn't worth finishing, which does happen to me sometimes. I had read half the book I started in the past, and then I read it up to this other moment in the past, which is when I decided it wasn't worth finishing. The present perfect can suggest also that something happened recently. For example, I say, I have started running. This suggests that I started sometime in the recent past, and it is still relevant today. For fun, just for fun, we can combine the perfect and the progressive as in, I have been running for 2 hours. This action started in the past and is in progress now. And let's unpack this phrase to show the remarkable amount of information you need to know to construct this completely mundane